Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show Monday through Thursday at 9 a.m. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. This is NPR News. I'm Chris Farrell, in today for Carrie Miller. Now, first of all, I want to wish everyone a Happy New Year. I sort of can't believe it's 2020. Really. But anyway, let's get to the topic of the hour. Caring for an aging parent can be a huge challenge and one of the most profound tasks that we take on in our lives. The same can be said about raising children. And there's a generation of adults best known as the sandwich generation who are balancing both the demands of raising children and providing care to aging parents. And these caregivers can experience, you know, great stress, financial burdens, and burnout. Caregiving also reflects, you know, the strength of family bonds between the generations. So how can caregivers take care of themselves even as they care for others? What can society do to help out? How can families talk about their expectations and hopes about caregiving? So for insight, we're joined by two guests. Ken Druck is a consultant, community leader, and author of the book, Raising an Aging Parent, Guidelines for Families in the Second Half of Life. And he joins us from San Diego. Welcome, Ken.
Thank you so much. Good to be with you this morning.
Teresa Ghilarducci is a labor economist and an expert in retirement security. She is professor of economics at the New School for Social Research and director of the Swartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis and the Retirement Equity Lab. Among her books is the co-authored Rescuing Retirement, and she is in San Pedro, California. Welcome, Teresa.
That's right. Thank you.
I have to tell you, Teresa, when I was a merchant seaman many, many years ago, that was one of my ports of call that we would pull into the port of San Pedro. So I have very fond memories of that.
Yeah. So, I see the entire global economy here.
Yes, you do.
You know, that's right.
So, but first, what I want to do is reach out to you. If you have a question for Ken or Teresa, give us a call, 651-227-6000, toll-free 800-242-2828. Are you taking care of both an aging parent and raising children? We'd like to hear your story. How are you managing the twin responsibilities? And, you know, are you taking care of an aging parent? You know, tell us about your experience. Again, those numbers are 651-227-6000 or toll-free 800-242-2828. So, Teresa, to give us some context, I mean, what are the estimates or how should we think about the economic value of unpaid caregiving by family members, you know, to America's aging adults?
Oh, that's right. If you calculated an hourly rate, you know, maybe $15, $25 an hour, the value would be a full-time job. And because women have traditionally done that work, daughters-in-law, it's been really undervalued along with a lot of other, you know, women's unpaid labor. But now I'm seeing lots of tendencies for men, for sons-in-laws to do the work. So it's not just unpaid female labor anymore. It is, like all care labor, totally undervalued. It's not counted in our GDP. And I don't think that people are understanding or really being mindful of how much work it is taking away from their other parts of their life, and that increases the stress. You know, pretending it's really not there or it's just incidental increases the stress.
And I was looking at Pew Research, you know, going through some of their research, and they had this figure that nearly half of adults in their 40s and 50s have a parent 65 and older and are either raising a young child or financially supporting a grown child, which is, you know, 18 years or older. And family's important. These figures are well known. You're talking about unpaid caregiving. Yet as a society, we don't seem to put much emphasis on providing support for caregivers.
That's right. Ken can speak to this too, but in the United States, we do not provide a lot of care facilities, either it be you know, preschool, you know, pre-K, after school programs, a systematic way to bring in caregivers and for older people. Even long-term care is a responsibility of the family. I'm really looking forward to a debate in the next year or two, and some of the presidential candidates actually have plans to put long-term care insurance into the Social Security system. And we're long overdue for that.
Yeah, and Ken, you know, I was reading your book. You have a lot of themes in there, but one of the things that really stood out to me is the need for caregivers to take care of themselves and not put all their energy into their responsibilities. They don't have a whole lot of support there either, though.
No, we don't. We often don't think of ourselves in those kinds of ways. We don't. I wrote something called The Handbook of Self-Care, and listing about 9 self-care saboteurs, ways that we talk ourselves out of refilling our own cups, replenishing our own energy, taking care of ourselves so that it's a sustainable effort on our part to take care of a parent or a partner. We don't know how to do this. We're not particularly adept at it. So for many of us, it's really downloading the new operating system for self-care and saying, how could I, you know, what in a perfect world, how would I be taking better care of myself, as well as using the resources and knowing what the resources of support are around me so that I'm not carrying the full load.
So what are some of those resources, or how about finding those resources of support?
Well, I think, you know, sometimes we have them right at our fingertips. If we're in front of a computer, we can begin to Google in our own community resources for aging, senior centers, senior programs, and we can begin to do the research. We can even get our grandkids to help us as a school project to look at, you know, what are the resources? How do we do this? And there are also professionals in our community provide at all levels, whether we can afford somebody, who's an advisor, a financial advisor, or whether we're going to need to find a financial advisor whose services are provided to us by the community. There are people who can give us good, wise counsel about what resources are available to begin to start thinking about everything from our retirement to our estate plan, the consequences of what it's going to cost us to live. Many of us, you know, are not in a position or haven't put ourselves in a position to really be able to afford. We're going to live longer than we can afford to. How are we going to deal with that? And instead, many of us are left, and you know, you talk about the sandwich generation, the younger, our adult children, they hear us talking about reverse mortgages and, oh, don't worry about it. I spoke to somebody on the phone about a reverse mortgage and all these financial schemes that, you know, we may not know a great deal about and need perspective on.
Exactly. Well, let's go for perspective. Let's go to the phones, and we're going to go to Eric in Minneapolis. Eric?
Hi there.
Hi. What's your comment or observation?
Well, being in Minnesota, a lot of our folks move to Florida or someplace warm, and it's really difficult to give care long distance. You got to get somebody to help you. You've got to navigate an unwieldy system that's geared towards Medicare dollars, et cetera, and it's really tough to do long distance.
And is this something that you're coping with?
I did, in fact. Yep, it's really tough to do. And when you go down in person and you see the folks that really don't have somebody local to advocate for them, there's a big difference between, I think, the have and have nots of somebody in person to advocate for folks.
So just one other quick question for our listeners. Did you come away with some insight or some piece of advice that you would, you know, recommend for people who are confronting a similar circumstance to you?
I think there's nothing like showing your face and being in person. And I honestly believe that perhaps when a large amount of care is necessary, staying long distance might not be the thing. Maybe a move back to Minnesota is in order.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Thanks for calling. Ken, any reactions?
Well, it's pain. I can feel his pain. You know, you want to be a good son or daughter to your aging parent, and for either health reasons or financial reasons or the idea of living in a residential community in a warmer environment, they move to Florida or they move to California or they move somewhere else. And how do we maintain a contact with them? How do we continue to be a good son or daughter? Do we move to Florida? I mean, what do we do? They are at the mercy if unless they fall into the hands of a sibling that is taking care of them or a caregiver who really is a strong advocate. They're kind of at the mercy of other resources. And how can we continue to be advocates is a very important question. And sometimes it is an in-person visit. It's really traveling to that location and setting things up for them and then working remotely if we're not in a position to move ourselves. But I think that how much is enough question, which is a really important and very personal thing. How much is enough? How much? What bandwidth do I have to take care of my parents? And yet I have a life. I might have a marriage. I have kids I'm raising on my own. I'm trying to have a life and stay physically fit. It's a painfully difficult question and one that we should reflect on as well as talk about with a trusted confidant so that we can air out about it and get a good perspective.
So let me go ahead, Teresa. Go ahead.
Ken, I don't know if you agree with me, but I heard Eric say something pretty definitive, which is unless your parents are very wealthy and can hire reliable people to protect them when they move to Florida, it's a bad idea. You know, perhaps one thing to do is to go on vacation, you know, with your parents to a warm place, but discourage the move away from you. I'm really concerned about financial predators, as Ken pointed out. And I think they can take from people who even have a modest amount of means. And if you're away from people in those kinds of communities that are used to lonely, isolated, older people with $75,000, you know, in their bank account, it may be the best thing for children, even though it's personal, to discourage the move.
Well, I wonder how much of the figures that I looked at, multi-generational homes bottomed out around 12% of the population in 1980, and it's up to about 20% mm-hmm. of the population now lives in multi-generational homes, and there could be a lot of influences on that. But I do wonder if a part of it is at least what you're talking about, Teresa, which is, you know, we can keep better eyes on each other. We can have someone take care of the kids. We can also keep an eye on our elder adults. We can share some costs. That may be also pushing people toward multi-generational homes.
Maybe, but a financial planner told me something that really stuck with me, which is a lot of older adults, you know, our older parents that don't have the financial means to retire comfortably are often the ones that don't have children with an extra bedroom. You know, so
right.
That inequality in wealth and income that Ken alluded to, I think, really exacerbates itself because the government doesn't have good long-term care insurance or a really well-supported community of home health givers that could be gotten for on a subsidized basis.
Well, let me give out the number again.
I agree.
Oh, go ahead.
Again,
just 1 second. Let me just give out the number one more time. 651-227-6000, toll free, 800-242-2828. And one thing I'm really curious to hear from, if you're a millennial or a younger person, younger generation, are you taking care of elderly parents? Are you dealing with children? I mean, we'd like to hear from you. We like to hear your story. Now, back to you, Ken. Sorry I interrupted you.
No. It's great. And I also invite people who have gone through this experience, whose parents perhaps have passed, but who have a wealth of information and experience to share with us. I welcome their calls as well. You know, what I was going to say is that, yeah, the inequalities in our resources are extremely important when we have these conversations with our parents. And I'm suggesting that we begin to have these conversations, not when the house is on fire. We don't wait. That we need to open, just like we open lines of credit, we need to open lines of communication as adult children of aging parents, and as aging parents with adult children who are going to become our advocates, that we open these lines of communication as soon as possible, and that we cultivate these open communications, because to become an effective advocate, we have to know what resources our parents have financially, what they're going into their retirement with, and what they're aware of, what their friends are doing, what and how we are going to be involved, and to what degree we need to educate ourselves about resources, again, in the community, about helping them budget their future, and about discussions about whether they could set up a place to live in our where we live, in our own home, in an extra bedroom, in a granny flat, in our yard that we have helped them build. But all of these conversations are extremely important, and the sooner we have them, the better we are, I think, at planning in advance about what we're going to do.
All right, let's go to Rob in Minneapolis. Hi, Rob.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I've got a pretty interesting experience, at least I feel that way.
Okay.
I just, listening to what you're talking about really strikes me. My dad died about a year ago, and we're recovering. But yeah. my mom has dementia, and my mom was cared for by my father. And my dad did a great job of keeping me in the loop in terms of finances and all of that, and understanding where things were at, and was very careful with his money. And fortunately, the money is not really a concern. What he didn't do, he didn't really describe what was required in terms of caring for my mother. And so when my dad died, my family was really sort of overwhelmed with what to do. And we ended up, we weren't able to take care of my mother on our own because she has Alzheimer's and had some pretty significant issues with that. So we went to a facility that my dad had looked at. And long story short, we've been in three different facilities in a year with my mom due to the fact that, again, you're really in a pinch. And if you have somebody who has significant issues like my mom does with dementia, there's a lot of facilities that say they're ready to care for your parent, and the reality is they're not. And they don't tell you that until you're really in the thick of it. So I think my comment is
sure.
For people to, yes, have those conversations with your parents. Those are absolutely critical. It may feel awkward, but it's really important to know kind of all of the ins and outs as far as caregiving goes and where, you know, how much, you know, you can actually afford. The other is to definitely use references when you're looking at facilities. Contact them, do lots of visits before you commit to anything, because the message you're going to get from many of the facilities is that, you know, they understand dementia, they can handle all of it, but when you get in the thick of it, that's not actually what's happening. And oftentimes the ratios that you're being told in terms of care, you know, caregivers to, you know, to clients are much lower than what they should
sure.
be.
So, Rob, I'm really glad you called in. And I've heard variations of your story so many times. So I like both Ken and Teresa to comment whatever part that they'd like to off of your story. But I'll start with you, Ken, and then go to you, Teresa. Ken?
Well, first of all, my heart goes out to this wonderful son and, you know, having lost his dad and then having suffered what I call a living loss. A living loss is nobody's died, but the future that we had hoped for has been decimated. And, you know, having a mom, nobody, unless you've lived through it, understands what it's like to have a parent who is slipping away. Who you no longer recognize as your mom. You know, this is the version of your mom that can't even recognize you, and my heart goes out to him. But I also am in admiration of the way he's handling things and how wise he has become and how generously he's sharing his experience for those of us who are dealing with this right now or maybe dealing with it, you know, understanding that it's important to talk with both of our parents and have all of these ideas, having flushed them out in advance, as awkward as he said this is going to be, how important it is so that we know what they have asked for and what they also signed up for, because there are advanced directives, there are instructions, there are many things that they will ask for. And then, of course, doing the research and becoming an advocate and becoming knowledgeable about what resources are in the community is essential. And he's done that. And I think it's wise counsel to the rest of us.
And Teresa, I don't know what aspect you want to focus on, but part of his story would intrigue me, as I've heard this again and again, the difficulties of navigating the continuing care community, the assisted living centers, I mean, whatever terminology you're using, you know, actually understanding what are the services and what actually is going on here? What are you paying for?
I really want to speak to the macro issue. As Americans, having to do this on their own is so unusual compared to other countries. And yep. We really have to think big, you know, in terms of public policy. Could the Social Security Administration actually be funded for having a satellite of services that people need that are local to their community? Just like we have post offices everywhere, we have Social Security Administration offices everywhere. Can't that be like a one-stop shop for people who need to deal with that, you know, 20, 25 years of life? And if you're a younger worker and you have an aging parent, your relationship with the Social Security Administration office could be, you know, far longer. So with a public policy, you know, and imagination, we could really help all families. And all of us have to go through this, you know, and Ken can tell us about all the individual ways we will go through it, but all of us share an experience. And I just think we could do a lot more. It wouldn't cost very much. It's just really about coordination and having somebody there who's seen it all before to help a family who's never seen, you know, their particular problem.
If you're just joining us, I'm Chris Farrell in today for Carrie Miller. Our conversation is about caregiving. My guests are Ken Druck, author of Raising an Aging Parent, Guidelines for Families in the Second Half of Life, and Teresa Ghilarducci, labor economist and expert in retirement security. And of course, more importantly, we want to hear from you. So give us a call at 651-227-6000, toll-free 800-242-2828. Are you helping out an aging parent? How are you coping? Are there reforms or changes in our society that you think would help you out? Tell us what you're thinking. Again, 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. And I want to go right back to the phones to Josh in Minneapolis. Josh?
Good morning.
Hey, what's your comment or observation?
Yeah, well, good morning, all three of you. I appreciate the conversation. Very thoughtful. A few months ago, I was having a happy hour with some friends all about my age. I'm an older millennial, mid-30s. And we kind of came to this conclusion we were blown away by, which is that our parents collectively seem to avoid talking about finances with us. And we were trying to put our finger on why, because this is exactly the reason for the conversation, was how do we plan for, you know, taking care of them in,
right,
in the long run. We all reached this conclusion that they felt guilty, that our generation really, really got hit with incredible tuition increases and student loan debt, and the fall of, you know, the economy hit right when we were entering the workforce. And it seems like they're avoiding because out of this guilt that we're still, even in our mid-30s, trying to dig out of that. Whereas, you know, when they were our age, they were maybe a bit in a bit better position.
You know, Josh, I have to applaud you and your friends, because I was at a presentation a couple of months ago out in California, and I think the number was out of the survey. It was a survey, but a pretty large survey of people 50 and over, was only 18% of older adults had a conversation with their adult children about their finances. And so, you know, I applaud you for at least, hey, we need to have this conversation. I think that's great. Ken, how do you start this conversation? You've mentioned the importance of the conversation, but okay, give us some practical tips. How does Josh and his friends, how do they start a conversation with their parents who may very well be dealing with understandable guilt?
Yeah, Josh, I wrote a book 3.5 years ago called Courageous Aging for Your Parents to deal with all of the entire psychology of what it means to be turning 55, 60, 65, 70, 75, and so on. And the response that I got, the biggest response I got to that book, which ended up being an Amazon bestseller, was from millennials saying, what about, you know, how do I talk to my parents? My parents don't want to talk about it. And whether they're feeling guilty, which is causing them to avoid it, or uncomfortable or embarrassed, you know, is hard to say. I have to look at every individual situation. But I started having, then I wrote this current book, Raising an Aging Parent, and I've been giving programs around the country. And we give this intergenerational program, which is a panel discussion of millennials and their aging parents. And we talk about these issues. We open the door and open the conversation on, you know, what are the things we should really talk about that are essential to talking about? And do you feel guilty? There's an opportunity to ask your aging parents, do you feel guilty that you were hit, you know, that we were hit with student debt and all these things, and that we're not going to be able to enjoy some of the beautiful things that you've had, some of the freedoms, some of the enjoyment that you've had because you have a financial burden on you. And those are important conversations that everybody is different. Every family's different, but we need to be in those conversations as communities. And thank goodness for Teresa and the work that she's doing so that we can look at how can we systemically and as a nation brace ourselves, open the conversation, educate the general public so that we're talking about these things and we're providing structures in our communities and through our government that support families going forward.
And Teresa, go ahead, Teresa.
Yeah, no, I think that it's so hopeful what Ken just said. What really could start the conversation is to understand that a lot of older people now are feeling deep shame. And fear that they don't have enough money. So you are painting the picture of a more prosperous, you know, a generation of parents worrying about their unprosperous young people. I think they're feeling very afraid that they don't have enough for retirement. So I think the best conversation to have, maybe at the beginning or in the middle of the conversation, is a simple math exercise. The way to start talking about this issue with your parents is to say, hey, mom and dad or mom, do you feel like you have enough money when you're 60 and 70? And then that gets into a very concrete conversation about how much debt they might have and how much pension income they expect to have or how much they have in their retirement plans. Half of people don't have anything in their retirement plan. So the conversation may quickly be about debt and Social Security. So I think a math conversation is absolutely necessary within the feeling conversation.
Interesting. To follow up, you wrote about a 100-page book on planning for retirement, and which I really enjoyed a lot. And one of the things that I've become convinced on when we're talking about planning, thinking about retirement, and of course, a lot of it is, you know, if you have access to a 401k or a 403b, or if you don't, you know, all the financial stuff. But I come convinced that it's actually the conversation that we're having right now is actually the key, is a conversation within the family about what are the assets, what are the liabilities, what are the expectations, what are the hopes, what happens when we have cognitive decline, that actually is this conversation is actually the core of thinking about aging.
Yeah, absolutely. And also to know that your needs when you're in your 60s are really going to be different than the needs you have in your 70s and 80s. And usually the expense gets higher, not lower, and assets fall. So that math conversation just makes all the fears real. And then you can go from there about how to handle that. But but I agree with Ken and you, Chris. The earlier you have these conversations and how sensitive you are about the shame, where many adults feel like it's their fault that they're not prepared for retirement, the better off people will be.
All right, let's go to Laura in New Hope. Laura?
Hi. Thanks again. I know everybody is thanking you for having this conversation, but it's so important and it's so hard to talk about for a lot of us. I told your phone answer that I didn't really know what I was going to say, but my experience is, so I'm a millennial, I'm 33. I have three young children, and my two parents are both living and are both living in assisted living community nearby. And we are very lucky to have the financial resources to make that possible.
Right.
And I'm a stay-at-home parent, and so it's fairly easy for me to find the time to attend, you know, care conferences and to help at the assisted living community with whatever they need, because unlike a lot of people think, putting a parent in an assisted living community does not mean that everything is handled. It just means that there are a different set of things that you have to think about every day.
Yeah. And you have to manage their finances. Is that also on your
list
of things?
Exactly, it is. Mm-hmm. And like I said, we're very lucky to have the financial resources to make it to make it possible for them to live there. But since my dad moved down here and into assisted living in May due to very sudden onset of dementia, I've had to sell three properties that they owned remotely. And deal with just all of the ins and outs that come with having an aging parent, especially one who suddenly sort of lost capacity. And that was a terrifying experience to, you know, get a phone call that your dad's in the hospital and he doesn't know who he is. So you need to, you know, come rescue him, which was very, very challenging. But just this whole conversation that you all are having about my generation and how hard it is for us to care for aging parents, to care for young children, and to try to also care for ourselves in the midst of all of that. I guess I just want to say thank you for talking about it, because it really is almost impossible to feel like you're doing a good job at all three of those things. Caregivers.
Yeah, and I'm sure you are doing a good job. But, of course, with all the stress and the time, you know, that's tough. Thank you for calling in. I really appreciate that. And I'd like now to go from Laura. Let's go to Kristen and Blaine. Blaine? Yeah, Kristen. Sorry. Hello, Kristen?
Hi. Yeah, I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
I am also a young mom. I have three young kids, and I also work full-time. And I have two sisters who are grown. And I guess my question is, my parents are farmers. I grew up on a farm. And, you know, they're doing great now, but we come from a family of farmers. And how do we do kind of at that question of, you know, I think about how do we transition 10, 20 years ago or from now to keep the family farm. We have cousins whose parents are aging and they can't continue to farm, but they want to live, you know, on the farm, but they can't operate it. So we're kind of in that. I don't know if you have any recommendations or experience with families who live in rural Minnesota.
I mean, my own reaction is that and because you're starting early, would be working with some professionals, financial planners who have an understanding of the farm community, and farm taxes are unusual compared to some other taxes and some of that whole area. So starting early would allow for a lot of conversations and getting your family involved. But let's go to Ken. Ken, any additional reaction?
Well, Kristen, first of all, you know, what you're doing is amazing. Your family is so blessed to have you to have a daughter, much as our last caller, to have somebody who has a heart like yours, who really wants to help the family move forward through these transitional times, who's thinking about succession planning, and whether it's rural Minnesota or a family business in Oakland, California, succession planning is an important step. It's like, is the business, is the farm going to be able to go on, and who in the succeeding generation is interested and qualified to take it over? How are we going to do that? Where are mom and dad going to live, and so on? Those are all important conversations, even though awkward, and important conversations to perhaps tone in the same gentle, loving, respectful way that you've expressed yourself on this call. And I think the tone that we set in bringing up these kinds of issues and having these conversations, it really determines the success of the conversation. It allows people to relax and really explore all the best possible futures scenarios. And to do that together as a family brings a family closer together. You know, life has its own terms. We get old, if we're fortunate, we get older, and we go through these transitions, and we become the older version of ourselves. And I think sometimes in this country, we forget that. We kind of live in an avoidance of that, and it takes somebody in a family to say, hey, you know, let's evolve into the best expression of ourselves, because change is coming.
Teresa, anything to add?
No, just to point out that Chris said, you know, talk to a professional, because that professional will help you do the math problem. The reality-based conversation is really important, so that people don't have magical thinking about what the stock market will do, or what the value of the farm will be, or things will work out. You need to have a practical math conversation.
So let's go to Cindy in Grand Fork. Cindy?
Hi. So I'm calling. My parents are quite a bit older. They're in their 80s and 90s. And I've been their sort of primary emotional support for the last 5 or 6 years. They moved to the town that I live in, and were able to live on their own in an apartment for a couple of years, and then moved to a kind of a low-level care. And then 2 years ago, they both got pretty significant illnesses. They both have chronic health issues, but became pretty significantly ill with the flu. And that triggered the need to move them into a higher-level assisted care facility. And one of the things that I was unprepared for is how hard it was going to be for them to be able to stay together. They have been married for over 60 years, and a lot of their support, of course, comes from each other. They're a very tight couple. And we had to advocate really, really hard to even find a place where the two of them could live together in the same room once they got to that slightly higher level of care. And that went through their savings very quickly. So they now are paying with it through a combination of Medicare and medical assistance. And it's weird because it seems like the system, both in terms of the compensation structure and in terms of the way a lot of the assisted living facilities are built, really doesn't support the idea of keeping couples together as they age and go through this. And I'm just, that was a big surprise to me, to realize that a lot of the effort that we would be expending would be in trying to keep them in a living situation that would keep them healthier and happier by being able to be together. We've finagled something so they can kind of share a room, but we're facing a situation now where that's probably going to end. And so any insight you have about that would be really appreciated.
So, Teresa, you know, they run through the savings, and this is where you start getting into the Medicare, Medicaid rules, and how do you navigate this assisted living rules?
Yeah, I think she's right on top of it. And the key is having money yourself or having some kind of a collective strategy. I think that if she found other people that were in the same situation, and that they presented the problem back to either the facility, you know, or to the local politician, then you might actually have some creative solutions. But people trying to work these things out on their own, I know, doesn't work very well.
Yeah, and, you know.
Can I add something?
Yeah, please.
I'd like to add, you know, that you are a pioneer. You're describing a situation that countless thousands of people are going to be facing in the years to come. and you've articulated it so clearly, and I'm going to make an offer to you. I would love to help you sit down and write up a few pages describing your parents, how you have had to fight for your parents to stay together, the loss that they have been threatened with suffering, the loss of their relationship at a time where that's exactly what they need, and how, whether it's residential senior communities or assisted living facilities, need to flex to that, and to write something up so that you can become the leader and the advocate for this important conversation and get facilities to really look at and examine how they can support couples of aging parents and people who've been together in maintaining that important element so they don't end up alone and lonely.
Yeah, that's a really and her parents are just so lucky they have her advocating for them. Let's go to Pam in Maple Grove. Pam?
Hi.
Yes.
I really appreciate the conversation. My mother, 2 years ago, she went for heart surgery. And during heart surgery, which was minor, she had a stroke. And so we were all up in the air. So she went to rehab, and I made it my goal to take care of my mother and never leave her alone and keep her in her own house. And I did that. I took a leave of absence from work. I was a school bus driver. I still am. And we had no income then. So my partner, who was on Social Security disability, took care of the rent and the animals in our other place. And I stayed here and took care of Mama. And we've got the wonderful support from the intern health service. They came in and did her health care. She had a savings, and it wasn't much more than $40,000. And we went through that, taking care of her needs, and we were not allowed to get help from the county because of her savings that she worked so hard for. So we just said, okay, that's fine. So I moved in, stayed with her 9 months until she passed, and I was exhausted.
Oh, I can imagine.
I never complained because what I gave her and what she gave me was something that can never be taken away from me. And I was around-the-clock care. I was the only care provider for her. And my partner would come when she could, once or twice a week, just so I could sleep. But what frustrates me is people don't get it as far as taking care of our elders, taking care of our parents. I just felt lost. I felt totally lost. I was by myself taking care of her. I got support from the hospitals and from the interim health care, but it's so frustrating that our parents are looked at as less valuable than other human beings.
Yeah. And
does that make sense?
Go ahead.
No, I said, does that make sense to you?
Oh, it makes more than sense to me. And are you going to be working longer because you had to, you know, take all this time to help take care of your mom?
Oh, yeah. I'm 65 right now. I don't plan on, I can't. We went through our savings, and that's okay. This is not a complaint. Okay,
no, I understand. Absolutely. No, you're not complaining. Yeah. But that is the reality that, you know, you and other people who face in this situation, you go through your savings, and it has real implications for you and your life and what you can be doing going forward. So it's that's why I think your story is both moving, heartbreaking, and also warm at the same time. I mean, it's a story. So Teresa, I mean, you write a lot about lower income families and confronting situations like this.
Yeah, I really wish you well in your work life. That was exactly my first question, is what are the implications for you for the next 5 years? I'm wondering if you have already claimed your Social Security benefits. Have you?
Oh, I think she's off. So go ahead. Just
she is. Okay.
Yeah. Give the advice though.
No. So we're finding that a lot of low income, older workers are claiming their Social Security in order to supplement their low wages, and it's something that we never thought would happen. We thought this idea that you could accrue more Social Security benefits if you delayed until all the way up to 70 would help people stay in the labor force and get a higher Social Security benefit. And we were really gobsmacked by the data.
that showed that lower income older workers are collecting while they're working, so they never get that delayed retirement credit. This is the paper we're going to publish in a couple of months. So the advice I would give to older workers is to, if that's the alternative they have to having those savings, but to delay collecting Social Security, do everything they can to delay collecting Social Security. But also, I think there are a lot of programs that the public can provide so that people don't have to draw down their own savings to help their older parents. We're worried about people drawing down their savings to help their kids through college, but I think this is another pioneer field where people are drawing down their retirement savings to take care of their older parents. And again, I feel like, Ken, all of these stories are just the tip of the proverbial iceberg that this is going to face a lot of people in the coming 10 years.
That's right. Let's go to Susan in Edina. Susan?
Good morning. Important information here. I work as a professional at Better Business Bureau, and our data shows that so oftentimes older adults are not having that conversation not only about finances, but by also who will care for those big decisions. And oftentimes it's not the robocall from overseas or the bad guy in the Caribbean that's stealing the money. It's the son-in-law who's been bestowed the single decision or oversight of financial matters without sort of a secondary person to intervene. And oftentimes older people, they might sell a home, come into some money, insurance money, whatever, and not really have the financial literacy. So just wondering what the experts on the line here today can talk about, because fraud is such an essential part of what's happening to our elder population, and certain safety measures implemented ahead of time can prevent that.
No, fraud is just absolutely huge. So in the minute that's left to us, Ken?
Well, we have we're getting on top of this in San Diego for sure. Our district attorney and the DA's office has specific people and units who are on this all the time, giving public education and providing immediate one-stop shopping visits for people who suspect that this might be happening in their family.
Teresa?
The research shows is that fraud is perpetuated by family members. I am really sorry to say that, but I think that's the reality. And giving it to somebody who's either a thief or giving it to somebody who's is actually just not trained is highly likely. I'm thinking that a fiduciary at a bank would be best for a lot of people, but they charge too high fees. Again, we need a collective solution. The court should have a list of people who, for a low fee, can take care of people's finances. But the family member is not often a good resource.
Yeah, so I've got 30 seconds left. This is unfair, but we have a whole full bank of callers who would like to share their story, and all these stories are moving. So, Ken, very quickly, what is your final thought?
The second half of life is complicated, and it can be as rich and beautiful and full of opportunity for family and togetherness and health and well-being as we make it. But we need to get into these conversations. We're just at the edge of talking about it as a culture. And yep. I so appreciate you, Chris, for taking the time to do this.
Thank you very much. Thank you to both of you. Ken Druck is author of the book, Raising an Aging Parent, Guidelines for Family in the Second Half of Life. And Teresa Ghilarducci is professor of economics at the New School for Social Research. Thank you.
Programming is supported by Concordia College in Moorhead, where career preparedness, from exploration to experience, begins the moment students arrive on campus and continues throughout their 4 years. More at ConcordiaCommitment.com.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. You can learn more about our show by searching for NPR News with Carrie Miller.